Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips, and we are joined now by Dr. Peter Dale Scott. Peter Dale Scott is Professor Emeritus of English at the University of California. He is a former Canadian diplomat. He's a poet and author who has published more than a dozen books and collections of poetry, many developing the self-coined concept of deep politics. He is author of many books, including Cocaine Politics, Drugs, Armies, and the CIA in Central America, and Deep Politics and the Death of JFK. His most recent books include The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America, and American War Machine.
Peter Dale Scott, you've been following the JFK assassination for probably 50 years now. Tell us your history and how you saw it initially. How did you see it when you found out? What did you think about it?
Well, I came in really through the back door because my interest was the Vietnam War and how to stop it. And I did a book with Franz Schurman and Reggie Zelnick called The Politics of Escalation. I think it was the first anti-war book to come out in 1966. And I just asked a question in one of my chapters in that book. Is it a coincidence that Prime Minister of Vietnam, Nguyen Xuân Diem, started to explore the possibility of neutralization and an end to the war, and he was then assassinated, clearly with CIA involvement, and then 3 weeks later, the president, who was also beginning to explore withdrawal from Vietnam, he also was assassinated 3 weeks later, but it was just a question. But the question rested in my mind, and I began to get more and more interested in it. And I wouldn't say I was really primarily pursuing the Kennedy assassination until about 1970, and I became very interested around then.
Well, you have written fairly extensively about Kennedy's efforts for global peace, and certainly Memorandum 263, which was his declaration to remove 1,000 troops from Vietnam early on.
By the end of the year, yes, by the end of 63, and the bulk of them by 65.
So it was clear that his desires at that point were to withdraw from Vietnam and move towards greater compatibility with the Soviet Union and even some attempts at reconciliation with Fidel Castro.
Yes, I think they're actually all more intimately connected, interconnected than most historians have recognized, because I think that all through 63, Khrushchev was pulling troops out of Cuba. He had about 17,000 troops in Cuba, and through 63, he was pulling them. And McCone, I think, estimated in August it was down to about 8,000 or something. Well, no one's ever explained why they kept saying the war was going well in Vietnam for the American point of view in 63, but Kennedy pushed up the number of troops that we had in Vietnam from 9,000 to, guess what, 17,000. So I think it's not a coincidence that you had a parity of troops in the two countries, Cuba and Vietnam, at the same time. And that one of Kennedy's secret negotiations with Khrushchev involved a phased withdrawal on both sides. You get more troops out of Cuba, we'll get more troops out of Vietnam. And that was actually, I think, happening, and it disturbed certain people, and it was, of course, stopped. It was actually announced on November 20th, 2 days before Kennedy was killed, that 1,000 troops would be withdrawn before the end of the year, and they never were. So those people who say it makes no difference if you have Kennedy or if you have Johnson, one of the first things you can point to is this troop withdrawal, which was announced, and they had 5 weeks in which to do it, and it wasn't done.
Part of what you've written about is the idea that Lyndon Johnson was receiving different intelligence than Kennedy was at the time, and that there were certainly elements inside the Pentagon that not only wanted to see the war in Vietnam grow and expand, but were really rabid anti-communists in the sense of maintaining a really hard line with the Soviet Union. At the same time, when Kennedy, John Kennedy, is starting to have these communications with Khrushchev,
right.
Because of the severity and the closeness that we came during the Cuban Missile Crisis to a nuclear exchange.
Yes, I think that certainly educated both Kennedy and Khrushchev to the need to rethink the Cold War. And we have to look at this at different levels. I mean, first of all, it's quite clear Kennedy's American University speech on June 10th, 1963, you have to have lived in those days to understand just how extraordinary this was, that he was saying we are all mortal. I mean, that we have a common interest in preserving the planet from a nuclear disaster. And this was very, very new, something that seems rather minor now, perhaps, the Test Ban Treaty in August. That was the first treaty that had been signed with the Soviet Union since the Austrian Peace Treaty of 1955. And the argument against it wasn't the details of the test ban. It was you cannot sign a treaty with the Soviet Union because they are atheist communists and their commitments mean nothing at all, and only a traitor would have any idea of doing something like this. So there was extraordinary opposition inside the military, inside Congress, through the establishment of the country to dealing with the Soviet Union. And then when you come down a notch to the future of the war in Vietnam, I'll just give you my own take on it because there are many, but I think the oil companies had their eyes on oil in the South China Sea, and Mobil Oil in particular, which is a Rockefeller company. It's part of the old Standard Oil Trust. It used to be called Saucony Vacuum there. Saucony was Standard Oil Company of New York. So it was one of the basic companies, but they were short of foreign resources. Unlike we talked about the Seven Sisters in those days, the big mm-hmm. oil companies. All of them had, by the terms of those days, enough resources except Saucony Vacuum. And so this man, William Henderson from Saucony Vacuum, he was lobbying up and down in the country in the Council on Foreign Relations and in various journals that we need to have a bigger military commitment in Southeast Asia. Why? Well, they talked a bit about the domino theory said so we can protect Indonesia and so on. But I think they specifically were interested in the waters off Cambodia and Vietnam. And the Cambodia incursion in 1970 was involved the Lon Nol government that was signing. Most people don't know this, but I have a chapter on it in my Drugs, Oil, and War, about signing contracts with Western oil companies, which were fulfilled. They're drilling. Their oil is coming out from that area. And, of course, they never got there was a setback when we, in effect, lost the war in Vietnam. But lo and behold, 20 years later in the 1990s, who is drilling oil in Vietnamese waters? It's Mobil. They got the oil in the end, even though they didn't win the war that they thought was necessary to get it. So that's why there was pressure. Obviously, there were people in the military who also wanted that war. But there's a new book out by Christopher Ricks that says that really the old guard in the military were not so keen on this war. It was Maxwell Taylor, Kennedy's preferred choice to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He was a proponent of limited war, and he wanted to have a limited war. And more or less, he was the heart of the military push for involvement there.
And there certainly were companies like Bell who were building helicopters that became one of the primary war machines in Vietnam.
Oh, yes. Once the war was launched, you had a huge helicopter lobby, Bell in particular, and also Boeing, because when we were bombing North Vietnam, We lost an awful lot of B-52s. It was terrible for the pilots in them. It was terrible for the North Vietnamese, but it was wonderful for Boeing. So they, too, were Boeing and Bell. The military-industrial complex that Eisenhower had warned about became very invested in the Vietnam War when it was going. And in one of my theories, which I've mentioned in, I think, finally in the war conspiracy, there was a company down in Texas in the Dallas-Fort Worth area called Ling Temco Vought, LTV. And James Ling, who was the head of that company, teamed up with a man called David Byrd, D.H. Byrd. They called him Dry Hole Byrd because of his oil drilling fiascos. But he also owned a Texas school book depository where Oswald was supposed to have shot Kennedy. And the two men, the owner of LTV and the owner of the school book depository, they formed an investment company and bought a lot of shares in LTV just before the assassination. It's just like before 9/11, somebody was buying shares, selling short in the shares of the airline that went down. And I did the math on that investment. They put in $2.5 million. And by 1965, that was worth about $50 million because the first contract that was awarded by the Pentagon under Lyndon Johnson was to LTV for what they called the Vietnam fighter, the A-6 fighter. When that contract was let in January of 64, so I've always wondered if that wasn't part of the background, what I call the deep politics of the Kennedy assassination.
We're speaking with Peter Dale Scott. This is a special program on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips for the Project Censored Show. Peter Dale Scott, you just mentioned the term deep politics. So let's go deep. Let's go there. let's talk about what do you mean by deep politics? I mean, while you were just speaking, I couldn't help but think of so many other events, the Gulf of Tonkin mess that was used
right.
as
that
a front.
That would be an example, too.
And of course, those events were used, you know, as a ruse, you know, to really try to build a public, and the military-industrial complex benefited greatly from this. But as you're saying, there's a lot going on behind the scenes that the public never sees.
Well, let me start with deep politics, and then we'll get to what I call deep events, like mm-hmm. the Kennedy assassination. Deep politics is a term which I had to use to be able to conceptualize and write about what it was I had to say about the Kennedy assassination. And I did a whole book called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, and I said, I'm not trying to solve it, and I'm not even particularly, what does solving the case mean? Does it mean we find up the gunman saying, I shot the gun? That wouldn't answer the questions that I'm interested in. I'm not interested in who shot the gun. I'm interested in why the president was shot and what interests were served by that. And to look on that level, you have to look underneath the surface at things which are not acknowledged. And so my definition of deep politics in that book is all those political processes that are usually repressed, not talked about, rather than acknowledged. And actually, I came in, I really did it in connection with Jack Ruby. Jack Ruby was the man who shot Oswald on television 2 days after the assassination, which was certainly an event which merits as much investigation as the shooting of the president. And, of course, the thesis of the Warren Commission and their report was that both men were loners. Lee Harvey Oswald wanted to be famous, and so no one paid any attention to him. We now know that wasn't true because the CIA was not only maintaining files on him, but significantly escalated their files on Oswald in the weeks just before the assassination, which makes you wonder if they didn't have something to do with it. And Jack Ruby, even more conspicuously, that's why I knew nothing about American politics at that time, but just a little bit of investigation of this supposed loner Jack Ruby turned out that, he had connections to organized crime. But more than that, he ran a nightclub or a couple of nightclubs in Dallas, and they were strip joints. Well, Dallas culture being what it was, strippers were used not just in strip joints but also at big parties given by very rich oil men. So Jack Ruby knew a lot of the oil men. Well, he was not a loner. He was well known. He was a character who was recognized. And in particular, he had very close connections with the Dallas police and, in fact, employed Dallas police to be bouncers in his clubs. And I found one of the very few published pre-assassination FBI reports on Jack Ruby was about a drug deal that went through Dallas, a big one, and the man who had to give the okay on the drug deal was Jack Ruby, according to this FBI file. So this FBI file was suggesting that Jack Ruby was, in fact, the connection between the underworld in Dallas, who were quite powerful, and the Dallas police. Well, you couldn't have a better example of what I mean by deep politics, that crime in Dallas wasn't just regulated by the police, it was also regulated by the mob. The organized crime serves a function in society. That's why it's tolerated. I thought at one point of calling it tolerated crime. They certainly had an understanding with the Dallas police that small-time drug dealers got turned in, got arrested, made good publicity for everybody. Big-time drug dealers went through no problem. And that was true in 1963, and may I say it's still true in 2013. It's part of the way that this country runs. We still have a prohibition. It's obvious to everyone that to have prohibition of liquor when everyone wanted liquor was a boon to the mafia. That's what really consolidated organized crime in America. Well, don't forget, we still have a prohibition. It's not liquor anymore, it's drugs. But there is still that very powerful demand which is met by very highly organized thing. My last book, American War Machine, the title is about the war machine, but a good deal of the content is about how there is this drug, organized drug system in the country, in the world, and how the CIA finds it very useful, used it in Mexico, used it in Thailand, used it in Laos and Vietnam. And then, of course, currently we're using drug dealers in Afghanistan. When we first went in, both times, first time 1980 and second time in 2001, our first connections were there with big-time drug traffickers who became CIA assets in order to fight the enemy, whatever it was.
So in the context of John F. Kennedy and people who didn't like his administration, so to speak, and this wasn't just Catholic and political.
Oh, he had enemies. Yes, he certainly did.
He certainly had some serious enemies.
Yes.
Dulles, of course, who he fired, or the CIA.
That's a big one. Alan Dulles.
Alan Dulles.
John Dulles was dead.
Alan Dulles. So not only was the CIA unhappy, the Cubans, the right-wing Cubans, the ones at the Bay of Pigs, were very unhappy.
Right.
And Kennedy felt he had been lied to about the Bay of Pigs, and that's why he didn't trust the CIA. And Robert of the Justice Department was going after the organized crime in many ways.
Yes.
Including Hoffa.
And there's an overlap there, too, because a lot of the people who came out of Cuba were organized crime figures. The biggest American presence in Havana before had been the casinos. Very much the same. The world of Jack
Ruby had been down there doing bag money work, correct?
Yeah, three times in 1959 after Castro came to power, Jack Ruby flew to Cuba. He said, as a tourist, he said, three times in 1 year? No, he went out to Trescornia prison where Santo Trafficante was interned. He seems to have met Trafficante. He had a very close friend, Louis McWillie, who was in charge of one of the casinos there, and then came back and was at the Cal Neva right up here on Lake Tahoe, which where Sam Giancana had an interest. So Jack Ruby was part of that world and a functioning part because, yes, I think that's what the House Committee on Assassinations concluded, that he was probably getting cash out each time he went in there because they were stuck with an awful lot of cash in Cuba, which they couldn't reach.
Which reminds me that a lot of people don't remember that the House Committee on Assassinations did come to the conclusion that the John F. Kennedy killing was, in fact, a conspiracy.
A 95% probability of a conspiracy, they
said. Well, that's pretty high.
Yeah, it's high.
Right. But... of course, the Warren Commission didn't go there.
Not at all.
What did the Warren Commission ignore? I mean, certainly Jack Ruby's crime connections was one of them.
That's the first thing you have to say. They completely ignored, and it's so pathetic when you look at the reasons. You know, I'll give credit to the commission that they published 26 volumes of hearings and evidence. So when they said Jack Ruby was not crime connected, they're quoting somebody, and then when you look up in the footnotes to find who said it, it was, I think, Accardo, one of the heads of organized crime in Chicago. So the FBI went to organized crime to ask the question, is he one of your guys? And they said, no. The FBI said, great. And they put it in a memo, and the Warren Commission published it as fact. And that's an extreme example, but the whole case that Ruby was not organized crime connected, because it's entirely fictitious. The evidence for it is all bogus, and it was relatively easy to show how pathetic it was. In fact, Ruby was quite close to some of the very big killings in Chicago. There was a man called James Reagan who was killed in 1947, I think, in the 40s anyway. And the three suspected killers who were not charged because it was a very high-level political killing with protection for the killers. And Jack Ruby knew all three. And Chicago organized crime moved down in an organized way to Dallas, 1949 and 50. Jack Ruby moved from Chicago down to Dallas, 1949-50. Was he part of that move? Well, he knew all the people who were in the move. So whatever his status in organized crime was, he was part of – he knew the crime figures and he knew the police figures. And that's the first thing that the Warren Commission had in effect to lie about. Well, to repeat the lies that the FBI were repeating from Tony Accardo. But also, the fatal flaw in the Warren Commission was that the man who did most of the direction of the work was not Chief Justice Warren. He was still full-time on the Supreme Court. The man who was free to do it was Alan Dulles, who had been fired just 2 years earlier by John F. Kennedy. The very fact that one of the most prominent victims of Kennedy's political policies was named to the commission should have made people be suspicious from the outset. And not only that, but Dulles... acted, he put somebody, the man who was the go-between between the CIA and the commission shouldn't have been that person because of his closeness to what the CIA had been doing. I'm going to say, I cannot prove that the CIA had been doing something with Lee Harvey Oswald before the assassination, but I can certainly say categorically they had been doing something with the Lee Harvey Oswald files. They had been manipulating those files to the extent that on one day the same people sent out two different messages about Lee Harvey Oswald which contradicted each other. They said One cable said we have no news of him since 1962, and the other one brought it up to the present. I've written about this. I have an explanation for that. But all we need to know here is Lee Harvey Oswald was in their sites, and they were using the files. He was also involved in New Orleans. He came back from the Soviet Union in 1961, and for months and months and months, he did nothing political that we know about. And then suddenly, in the spring of 63, Oswald goes to New Orleans, and by August, he's connected with a group called I'll call them the DRE. It was a Cuban group that was financed by the CIA, that was part of CIA operations. And then he got into a highly publicized debate, and he got into arrest. He was leafleting. He was the sum of his activities was to he was a self-professed member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. He was the head of the New Orleans chapter, which had one member, himself. And he was doing things that ended up on television linking the Fair Play for Cuba Committee to a man, that is to say Oswald himself, who had defected to the Soviet Union, making it look like a communist front. Well, I think all of that was designed to blacken the reputation of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. And interestingly, we find that the CIA and the FBI both had projects at that time to do exactly that. Cannot prove that Oswald was part of those things, but we can prove that amazing things were happening in the CIA files. And then in the FBI file, look what happened there. Oswald got himself arrested in August 1963 for his Fair Play for Cuba activities. So you'd think, well, that would get the FBI more interested in him. What actually happens in October of 63 is that Oswald is taken off the watch list for dangerous communists who have to be watched. He's doing all these things, and they take him off the watch list. Why did they take him off the watch list? I believe they took him off the watch list because as he was accelerating his political activities, he had become in advance the designated culprit for the Kennedy assassination, and it was very important that nobody pick him up, and as he might have been. And I developed this idea that there's a designated culprit because – and there was more than one, actually, in the Kennedy assassination, some that you've not heard of. But the same thing happened with 9/11, that there were people who should have been watched by the FBI. The CIA wouldn't tell the FBI about these people. It was a complete violation of their procedures. And the FBI knew that the CIA was withholding evidence. I'm talking about 9/11 now. And got very angry in August of 2001, just 3 weeks before 9/11, an FBI agent sort of pounding the table says, somebody's going to get killed because of this. And yet the same thing happened. Why? Because the designated culprits were two of the alleged hijackers. My mind is open as to whether they were actually on the plane or not, but they were certainly part of the plot. And they shouldn't be – it would ruin everything if they got picked up before 9/11, just as it would have ruined everything if Oswald had been picked up before the Kennedy assassination. So that brings me to an expanded view of deep politics, which says that we study things about the Kennedy assassination that helps us understand – look for key points of similarity – with 9/11, and may I say Watergate. Now that you mentioned deep events earlier, these are what I call deep events, events which happen and which we know we are not going to get a straight account of in the press, and they are presented as the actions of people who are very, very marginal and of no interest to historians. But my theory of American history is that, in fact, these deep events and particularly the Kennedy assassination at one end and the 9/11 at the other, but also Watergate, all of them, the string of deep events actually steer our history and are largely responsible for us being the warmongering power that America has become in the last 50 years.
We're speaking with author and scholar Peter Dale Scott about deep politics and the death of John F. Kennedy for the 50th anniversary of that assassination. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored show for Pacifica Radio. And we'll continue our conversation about deep politics and the death of John F. Kennedy after this break. Stay with us.
This is Walter Cronkite in our newsroom. There has been an attempt, as perhaps you know now, on the life of President Kennedy. He was wounded in an automobile driving from Dallas Airport into downtown Dallas, along with Governor Connally of Texas. They've been taken to Parkland Hospital there. Let's go back to KRLD in Dallas.
Word just came to us a minute ago. The word we have is that President Kennedy is dead. He was shot by an assassin at the intersection of Elm and Houston streets, just as he was going into the underpass. The word we have is from a doctor on the staff of Parkland Hospital.
That was Zeddy Barker at our affiliate KRLD in Dallas, Texas. We have just learned Father Huber, one of the two priests called into the room, has administered the last sacrament of the church to President Kennedy. Regarding the probable assassin, the sheriff's officers have taken a young man into custody at the scene, a man 25 years old. We just have a report from our correspondent, Dan, rather in Dallas, that he has confirmed that President Kennedy is dead.
Welcome back to the Project Censored show, a special on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We're joined by author and scholar Peter Dale Scott, and we were just talking about deep politics and deep events, but we're going to go into more detail now about deep events, and specifically, maybe we can start by what you mean, Peter Dale Scott, when we talk about the assassination of JFK as a deep event, and then expand on that.
It was clear, I think, from the outset that there was not going to be a sincere investigation of who killed President Kennedy. There was, from the very beginning, there were all kinds of obvious reasons how Oswald couldn't have done it. The gun that he was supposed to have bought was much too clumsy an instrument to have pulled off, a feat of marksmanship that nobody could replicate. The FBI hired the top marksman in the country to replicate it with a vehicle that was not moving. And they could not do in the 6.8 seconds or whatever it was what Oswald was supposed to have done with a moving vehicle where maybe there was a tree obstructing the first shot. So Oswald, there were all kinds of problems. And yet, this is what I mean about the deep event. When Oswald was shot on November 24th, 2 days after the president was killed, the headline in the New York Times was, President's assassin shot. So they had already decided who did it. The FBI then very quickly did a report that decided that it was Oswald very, very quickly before getting into the evidence. The very first meeting of the Warren Commission, we now have that meeting, and there is Alan Dulles saying, of course, what we have to show is how all American assassins are not like European assassins. They're always loners. And actually, John McCloy, who's chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank, to his credit, he said, well, I don't think John Wilkes Booth was a loner, because if you know anything about the Lincoln assassination, there were three targets, two of whom were shot almost simultaneously in widely separated parts of Washington. And Alan Dulles, very cool, came back. He said, well, but John Wilkes Booth was so in charge that he was virtually a loner, even though he had a team. We now know that he had deep roots to the Southern Confederate intelligence network, though American historians don't like to emphasize that. But coming back, The commission was presented at their first official meeting with a complete agenda of what the chapters would be, and the first chapter was Oswald as the assassin. So they had the agenda before they had the investigation. That's a classic example of a deep event. And I've always felt, and we could waste a whole hour on this, that Watergate was another deep event. There's a lot of things we did learn about Nixon and Watergate, but I don't think we ever learned why those burglars were in the Democratic National Committee in the beginning. It was a disaster for Nixon. I don't think Nixon ordered it. Well, that raises the question, who did? We were never given a chance to find out. And then 9/11, most recently it was Syria. And we've had, I don't know if I'm getting off the subject here, but this question of chemical weapons in Syria, right away Kerry is saying, we know who did it. And only an idiot would challenge who did it. Well, I'm one of those idiots. I don't know who did it, but I know enough to know that it's far from an open and shut case that the Syrian government did it. And common sense would say to me that the people who had most to gain by using the chemical weapons were the rebels, because they wanted America to come in. So why would Bashar do that? It doesn't make sense. That's another deep event.
It's certainly false flags as deep events.
Deep events are often false flags, yes. Tonkin Gulf, for example, the second Tonkin Gulf incident turns out to have been a non-incident. I've written about this in my last, well, more than once, actually. I originally in the New York Review of Books, when I was not persona non grata as a conspiracy theorist, that very obviously the second incident was visible in Washington because of the very careful massaging of the available evidence. And there's now been a study saying that there were 115 pieces of evidence, and 90 of them said that there had not been an incident. But those were the ones that didn't go up to the White House, and the ones that went up were the ones that said. And same thing happened in the CIA. Somebody was about to send in a report saying it didn't happen, and his superior came in, so you can't send that. The decision had already been made, so the Tonkin Gulf was a deep event. And we have them all the time.
So with Lee Harvey Oswald, he's in the military. He's trained in Russian. He defects to Russia, mm-hmm. comes back with a Russian wife, and then creates this or becomes part of this Fair Play for Cuba.
Eventually, yes.
Eventually. Then ends up working at the book depository through yes. special arrangements from people inside government.
Right.
And then the route that Kennedy's going to take is changed the day before to bring his car by that building.
There's a lot of debate about that now, Peter. Everything you said up to that last statement I agree with. And 3 months ago I would have agreed with the last statement too. I've seen a very cogent argument that the alleged maps and so on, that it gets very technical here. But let's just stick with the crude part of it, that this man is given a job on what becomes the parade route, which is arranged by very high political people in connection with the Secret Service. And is it just a coincidence that this man with this very checkered past, he has what you would call the perfect legend for a killer, because he went to the Soviet Union. He also left the Soviet Union. He didn't like America. He didn't like Russia. He wanted to go to Cuba, but he didn't get to Cuba. So you can read anything you want into this Rorschach test of a background. So he's the perfect candidate for a designated culprit. Is it a coincidence? No, I think he was placed there. I can't prove it. But I agree with those who say that Maneker Carcano, it might have conceivably hit the president. It didn't kill the president. There was crossfire. There was another gunman. Again, you know, when you find that the Zapruder film, when it was printed in Life magazine, they altered the order of the frames in order to conceal the fact that the president's head goes sharply backwards, which is not what you would expect from a shot coming from the back. Well, there's huge literature in all of this. I'm mentioning this because that huge literature is corroboration. We have a deep event.
And then you go further in terms of deep events to not only talk about JFK, but the book you have where the war conspiracy, JFK 9/11, the deep politics of war. Mm-hmm. And then your newest book, of course, is the American War Machine,
right,
which ties in organized drug dealing worldwide, military empires,
right,
private companies. I mean, just this military-industrial complex, but 50 years later, literally changing things as they happen. But you look at it somewhat sociologically in the sense that, okay, during JFK and 9/11, there were stock market speculations before.
Right.
And other things that you see, like many of the senior officials of the country were absent.
Right, yes.
During those events. And what else is commonalities?
There are some things which could have been coincidences. You know, yes, it could be a coincidence that there were stock manipulations just before JFK, stock manipulations. We know there were just before 9/11. And again, the 9/11 Commission did a terrible job on trying to refute that, and they have been amply, I think, refuted in turn. But supposing they were coincidence, something that is more serious to me is internal to the conspiracy, and that is the president is shot, and 15 minutes later, there is a description of the killer put into the Dallas police messages, which is a description of Oswald as 5'10", 165 pounds, and that's exactly what was in his FBI file and exactly what was in his CIA file, but it wasn't true. When they actually measured him, and he was 5'9" and weighed about 140-something. The same thing happened in 9/11. Before 10 o'clock on September the 11th, we have it in Richard Clark's book that Watson in the FBI is telling him, we have a list of the people, the hijackers on the plane. Where did that come from? We don't know where it came from. We do know, by the way, there's been a lot of investigation of this. There were a couple of names on that list that have since been removed. One of them, for example, was already dead on September the 11th. So how did they know he was on a plane if the man was dead and underground? We don't know how they had that list as quickly as it, but it makes you think that they had pre-existing files on the whole thing, which were used for the composition of the plot. So the designated culprit picked out in advance, and I think I already mentioned that there's an increase of file activity on Oswald just before the assassination. And there is an increase of file activity on the alleged hijackers just before 9/11. So I think that's a very important similarity. And I don't know, you have my book there. What do I say about that?
Let's go a step further, Peter Dale Scott. The entire creation of the official commissions, the Warren Commission, the so-called 9/11 Commission, the commissions are designed to create or craft and then propagate an official narrative. There's a whole sort of other, what you might call deep politic or deep politic-like events underneath that, that attacks anybody that challenges the official narratives as conspiracy
right.
theorists. And, of course, the CIA hatched that to attack J. Edward Epstein and through their Mockingbird agents in journalism and
so on. They had a whole, by 1966, a series of directives of how to discredit critic of the Warren Report. Yes, the question of the commissions, it's not so scandalous that two commissions were appointed, one after each event. What is a scandal is that the wrong people were appointed to head them. The role of Alan Dulles as being the chief man directing activities on the Warren Commission staff when as I said earlier in this broadcast, he had just been fired by J.F. Kennedy, and there was a real tension, huge tension between Kennedy and the CIA. It shows how docile the press is that there was no press criticism of this.
Amazingly, Kissinger, when he was the first draft for Bush's 9/11 commission, and the Bush administration, by the way, as you well know, you could call it foot dragging, took over 400 days to get around to appointing a commission after 9/11. And then they appoint Henry Kissinger. I mean, that's an
incredible. They tried to, yes.
Right.
And I would point to the man that ended up being a co-chairman, Lee Hamilton. Lee Hamilton, I don't want to make him sound as if he's a murderous villain, but he is a professional cover-upper. I might almost say a designated cover-upper. And I have, in 1991, I did a book called Cocaine Politics, and from personal experience described how he was part of an elaborate conspiracy, that's the only word for it, to create a false impression that the Contras in the Iran-Contra scandal, the troops in, if that's what you want to call them, the irregular forces in Nicaragua that were being backed by America, to show that they had nothing to do with drugs. Well, they had everything to do with drugs. It was a false claim, and it had to be supported by false evidence, and Lee Hamilton played a role in contriving a false report to suggest that they had nothing to do with drugs, which was 180 degrees wrong in that case. So, yes, it's not the coincidence that there are two commissions, but that people who shouldn't have been appointed to run the commission are appointed to run the commission. And, of course, I would say particularly the director of the 9/11 commission was a man. He had done a book with Condoleezza Rice. He was part
– Philip Zelikow.
Philip Zelikow. The whole idea was to have a commission that had nothing to do with government. You look at the staff – almost all of them came out of the Justice Department, FBI, CIA. It was a pseudo-non-government.
And Project commission. For New American Century, a lot of those people were involved.
Right. The wrong people. That's what makes it.
Well, the right people if you're looking for a cover-up.
Yes, right, right, exactly.
Well, we only have a few minutes left in this segment, so we wanted to maybe get back to some of your thoughts on JFK on the 50th anniversary of the assassination. We certainly know there were a lot of problems with the Warren Commission report, falsifications, evidence that was never submitted. As you said, sort of the official theory and the official idea, the official narrative was already floated before the investigation even started, similar to 9/11. You know, we had all these kind of major problems. But where are you now, Peter Dale Scott, 50 years later? Where are you now in your mind on JFK? What could you share with people on what do you think really happened?
Well, first of all, I want to freely acknowledge to my friends like Noam Chomsky. He was elected as a hawk, no question. He was elected with the help of the so-called missile gap, the phony fear that we were way behind the Soviets when it came to missiles, when in fact we were ahead. And I think the Soviets had four functioning missiles into ICBMs or something. He was elected as a hawk. And this is pretty many, many people would say this. The missile crisis frightened him, and it also frightened Khrushchev. And these two men understood that there had to be a change. And I think not one but two different speeches given by Kennedy in June of 63 define changes in the man that helped doom him. The first one, which has often been commented on, was his June 10th American University speech, where he said, "We are all mortal, and we have to come to terms with the Soviet Union." The very next day, I think the news from Birmingham and the use of hoses on small children and dogs on small children. Kennedy, I think without much planning. Both of these speeches, by the way, didn't go through the bureaucracy. He had to do them outside. The second one, I think, was done very quickly, was the speech that we have to have a Civil Rights Act and end this torment in the South. And that developed a kind of coalition between people in the South who would happily kill. You know, most people don't know that when Kennedy was killed, there was celebration all through the South. It was they loved it, just the way that some people. Don't have time for this in this program. But when the towers went down in 9/11, there were people who celebrated not just in Pakistan, but in New Jersey. So there's something to investigate there. But the common denominator, I think, is the intelligence networks and the military, because you had a very high representation of unreconstructed Southerners in both of those places, particularly in the military, and high-level groups. I can't call the names to mind. They were very small, very marginal, but they were very extreme, who were talking in March of 63 about how to get rid of traitorous leaders. And you find Southerners who were also ex-military leading those things, the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, who went on a killing spree after 1963, killed so many civil rights leaders. They were not marginal loners. They were people who fit into the deep sort of infrastructure of our country, partly because of their connections in the military.
When we look at the Kennedy assassination and the Warren Commission coming out with a lone gunman, isolated individual, does it by himself approach, but there were other layers to that, and that was that Oswald had been reported to have been in Mexico City.
Yes.
Which is debated whether or not. In fact, that the CIA section chief there was a fellow named David Phillips, apparently, who was also in Dallas the day of the assassination.
Well, I don't want to attest to saying he was in Dallas. Almost everybody's been accused of being in Dallas. Howard Hunt was supposed
exactly,
to have been there.
If you read these George materials.
Walker Bush.
The first part of your statement is absolutely true, that he was there. And there was, of course, I don't want to get too technical here, but what really affected the way that the assassination was treated by Lyndon Johnson afterwards was the news coming out of Mexico that Oswald had been in touch with the Soviet embassy there. And I personally do not believe it was the man we think was Oswald. In fact, there's a one message that somebody who listened to the tape of the man who was claiming to be Oswald, everyone says he spoke very bad Russian. Oswald's Russian was not all that bad, but also he spoke very broken English. Well, if he spoke broken English, well, that's a pretty good prima facie argument that it wasn't our Lee Harvey Oswald. All of this, I think, I do think that what happened in Mexico was done with the assassination in mind, and it had the effect of creating what I call a phase one approach to the assassination and a phase two. Phase one approach is this involves Cuba or it involves Russia, and there are still people to this day, and they have CIA connections, who say that Castro did it or that Khrushchev did it. Both of these were insane. You know, I mean, the last thing, that's like Bashar wanting to use chemical weapons. Castro killing Kennedy was signing his death warrant. So what happens almost immediately after this phase one version, and there's, by the way, evidence for it, most of which got suppressed, but now has surfaced, and we see, oh, yes, they really did have some pretty good reasons to think that Castro did it. And now you move very quickly to the phase two approach is, we don't want to have a war, and I'm quoting Johnson now talking to Warren, persuading him to go on the commission, which he very much didn't want to do. We don't want to have a war in which millions of people die in a nuclear holocaust. So phase two is it was a lone nut. And nobody really believes it was a lone nut, but a lot of people are willing to go along with the lone nut thing because they don't want the false story that Castro did it to occupy the airwaves and get America involved in an unnecessary war against Cuba or worse still, the Soviet Union.
We're speaking with author and scholar Peter Dale Scott. We've been talking about deep politics and the death of JFK, and that about wraps it for this segment. Peter Dale Scott, in the last minute or two we have, any closing remarks?
Well, I would like people to think about what I mean by deep events, because if I'm right, I predicted, by the way, 20 years ago, that there would be more of them. And then we had 9/11. So my prediction proved to be true. And I want to repeat my prediction. Until we understand this phenomenon and expose it and deal with it properly, we will continue to have deep events that steer this country. And so if you liked what you heard here, investigate. You could even read my books. A lot of them are online. If you Google for me or go to my website at peterdalescott.net, America should investigate its own deep history if it wants to make go back to what America used to be. I am not anti-American. I am very pro-American. I'm not anti. I've also been in Russia and China and all these places. I lived for 2 years behind the Iron Curtain. I have good things to say about all these places. But as a Canadian, I really prefer America. But I want it to get back on the right track, and it must understand its history better if it's going to do that.
Peter Dale Scott, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, a special on the 50th anniversary of the death of JFK. Thanks for joining us.